Today we're going to talk about balanced training. So there's the idea that there are these set categories of exercise where you have to balance pushing and pulling in all of these planar two-dimensional representations. So balancing pushes or pulls, or even on the extreme end, people recommending that you have to do more pulling than pushing, because for some reason the thought was that we push too much. I don't know if that was a training bias thing or if the assumption was some sort of biomechanical bias towards pushing more.
Might be the fact of the resultant behaviors over time that are promoting the sort of compressive shape change, where if I compress the anterior aspect of the rib cage too much, then the shoulders appear to
come forward.
When the reality is it's the compression of the anterior thorax, which is actually quite common just in normal circumstances. And so that might imply, because of this antagonistic belief system of a push and a pull or an opposition, when they're actually very similar.
Yeah.
As far as the result, I think that might be the driver of that. And so we would see a lot of anterior posterior compression, which would, again, this is also associated with the anterior compression. Therefore, the postural perception
right.
is the fact that, oh, you're doing too many pushes, so we need to pull the shoulders back because that's the problem. The shoulders are forward, when the reality is it's actually the entire thorax that is compressed anterior to posterior, creating this resultant perspective.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of thought that people would become very knee dominant, quad dominant, pec dominant, bicep dominant, like everything in the front was for somehow closing. So it's a lot of it's going to come from the agonist antagonist thought.
Yep.
So that's going to be a lot of like Sherrington stuff. And then there's going to be a lot of like Yanda influence there of like an upper and a lower cross.
Mm-hmm.
So that would mean that just something, the tightness in front leading to a length or a weakness in the back.
Right. Basically. This takes us all the way back to like the stretch what is tight
strength
and strength what is weak. But the reality is like these are actually shapes and positions
right.
that are creating this representation. It's not a matter of muscular weakness versus strength on one side or muscular tightness on one side and muscular length on the other side. The reality is like when we have these compressive strategies, the reality is that we have muscle activity on both sides of the body that need to be resolved.
Yeah, and these big movers, these prime movers, the way that they're attached to the skeleton, it squeezes from front to back, mm-hmm. regardless of
correct.
Which exercise choice. And that's something maybe we need to put as a frame or an underlying thought, is when you do any exercise, you're squeezing everything.
Right. When you think about the point of highest force production.
Yeah.
Like the point where, and if we're lifting heavy enough, the point at where you would hold your breath is the point of highest force production, which is the point of greatest compression, which is the point of greatest internal rotation, right? So all exercises have that element in it. So if we were to say that, oh, a bench press and a row were opposed, right?
Right.
Let's say that, you know, again, going with the antagonistic perspective, it's like, well, first of all, they're not antagonists in that respect. It's like they're both compressive. Right. They're compressing different regions, but they're both compressive. Therefore, they're both going to result in a very similar outcome. So the stronger I get in those two activities, the more pressure I'm able to produce. Therefore, my gym strength goes up. Great. But the resultant behavior is more compression, less relative motions available. That is the consequence
right.
of increasing force, because they're both ending up producing the same result, which is the higher pressure and more compressed state. So they're not antagonistic. In fact, they're very similar in many respects.
Yeah, because the way that the lats attach, the way that the pecs attach, sort of creates this sort of pancaking from front to back compression.
Exactly.
And then even if you were to say like lay someone on their back to do presses and thinking that, okay, well, the back muscles are not contributing as much because it's laying on a surface. That may be true, but it's also the actual physical pressure of you against the bench is causing the same sort of compression that without the muscles. Right. And the muscles are still working.
Well, and then take into consideration the position in a bench press that most people will try to assume. They're going to try to add more and more internal rotation, more orientation to create a higher pressure axial skeleton, which is what you actually need to perform the lift.
Right. Anyone trying to coach for big numbers or big weights in the bench press is going to tell you to drive through your lats, pull your shoulders together, squeeze your butt, drive your hips up.
So compress your scapulae together.
Yeah. Right. You're still creating, it's a full body. Like watching someone lift a max weight in a bench press is a squat to a push. Like you see push into the ground, you see the compression going all the way up to the arms because it has to.
Just compare a max effort bench press feet on the ground versus pick like your feet up. And you immediately sense the difference in your ability to produce force. Well, the reason being is because you took away a ground contact that you need to produce this really strong, IR'd, highly compressive body shape that you're actually going to use for the lift. I take an element of that away, and then it becomes exceptionally difficult.
Right. So if it's not about pushing and pulling, because what we're saying, we're boiling this down to pushing and pulling how they're traditionally shown in exercise selection in the gym. Mm-hmm. It's squeezing. The end of the motion, the peak part of the force of the motion is an IR shape. The starting position of the motion, your setup position is an ER shape.
It has more.
So ER.
So under load, under load, we're always magnifying the compressive strategy because just to support the load alone, you have to have some measure. But if you think about, like, again, use your breath as the representation. So if I'm performing a very heavy squat, it's like, well, where do you take your breath? Well, you take your breath at the top of the squat and then you hold it until you get through that greatest point of force production, which would be most commonly referred to as your sticking point. Well, every bilateral symmetrical exercise or heavily loaded exercise is going to have that element in it, right? And that's where the similarities come into play. That's why they're not opposing. They're actually producing a very similar representation through the entire system.
Right. So let's talk a little bit more about, I mentioned it, but the concept that upper lower cross syndrome, you have this sort of rounded forward nature, you have hips that are anteriorly orienting, you have hip flexors that are super tight and almost like in the same way you have a rounded forward pelvis, you have a rounded forward thorax.
Correct.
And the thought that I'm going to somehow face pull or band pull apart or glute band work my way out of it because that's going to reposition the pelvis or reposition the thorax is that's a fallacy.
It's trying to bend another bend versus reducing the pressure, which allows you to actually expand vertically and then allowing you to expand again anterior to posterior.
Right.
That's where the reduction of the movement limitations are. It's actually in the reduction of the expand or the reduction of the compression.
Right.
Like if I take somebody that's already compressed anteriorly oriented and I try to pull them back against that, you're actually pushing them further forward into this anterior orientation.
Well, and you can feel it. It's like, what direction do you go when you do a row?
Yeah.
Like what direction?
Well, people think that you're going backwards. The reality is you're actually, well, it's a turn, but the reality is you are compressing yourself in the forward direction.
Right.
Yeah.
Both sides are compressing you forward and you're getting forward more and more. So you're losing anterior to posterior dimension and you're getting pushed farther forward every time.
Correct.
So then you end up with having to anteriorly orient your thorax and your pelvis in order to keep moving without falling down. Yes.
And this is a naturally occurring phenomenon in everyone. Like we all do this. We all project forward. And so we all, you know, all you have to do is go to the nursing home and you can see the end result of people that have never exercised in their life. And you will see the extreme representation of what we're talking about in that circumstance. It's like we're all drifting in this direction to some degree. Just by magnifying that with more load, the solution is not squeeze harder, push forward more, the solution, again, assuming we're talking about recapturing relative motions and not trying to increase force production to another magnitude, it's like the goal is like, I have to actually reduce that. And again, we get the vertical, we get the anterior posterior back, and then that's where we get our good motion back.
Right. And the relative motion part, that lends itself to consistency and longevity. And
then absolutely.
The force production part can be important, but you really need enough given the ultimate task or like
right.
the ultimate goal.
Right.
So if it's a sport context, if it's a high force, rate of force, repeated rate of force in a certain context, then you have to train for that.
Correct.
But if you're just trying to be healthy, maintain bone density, maintain muscle mass, maintain some sort of like power, like rate at which you can put force in the ground, which is like a huge marker of health
as
people age.
Yes.
Then it's more about, I guess let's reframe what balance training is for that, for like the health perspective.
Okay. So balance training is the ability to, I need the ability to produce force, right? That's what's going to keep me mobile against gravity.
Right.
So that is the reality, right? Taken to the extreme, the greater the compressive strategy, the more relative motion that I lose. And so this is where we start to see the orthopedic element come into play where, okay, I get a little bit of knee pain, or I get a little bit of hip pain, or I get a little bit of shoulder pain, or I have my back pain that everybody's going to have at least once in their life. Right. So if you want to talk about, and I hesitate to even frame it this way, but if you want to talk about balance, the balance is between the ability to expand access space, access movement capabilities, and the ability to compress enough. And it kind of like you were framing it as the terminal task.
Right.
And so the terminal task for, a typical fitness enthusiast, other than their aesthetics, is to feel good. And then the reality is like, well, if I want to feel good, I have to make sure that I can reduce this compressive strategy when it's time for me to move well. And then I need enough of this compression that I can satisfy whatever gym goal that I might have.
Right. And the one of the confounding things is people's association of looking a certain way right. and feeling good, because the aesthetic goal that most people, males specifically, are going for is a very, very compressed.
Yes.
representation. Sure. So someone who has like who's shredded in their abs, who has like carrying a lot of extra muscle, mm-hmm. that in and of itself lends itself to compression.
Yes. It gives the appearance of physical health.
Right.
But when you ask somebody to accomplish a task, and there are always exceptions, right? There are people that can train very aggressively and very hard and actually maintain a fair amount. But again, this comes down to like, what are you genetically capable of?
Yeah.
And then those people tend to be our outliers. And those aren't the people that we tend to see that have problems. So there are people that can get away with it. You just don't know who you are until you do it.
Right. And then people try. So these are the people that keep trying to train a certain way and they always hit some sort of setback. Yeah. Like this, their elbow thing comes back or their neck thing right. comes back. And it's right. just because they're training against nature, basically. They're going against what their body is really designed to do.
Right.
And they're not giving themselves the relative motion, the adaptability, the ability to stay upright against gravity right. with ease.
Yeah. Well, you just think about it. It's like the more extreme your adaptations in one direction, the more you have to give up to do that. And so, if you use the extreme representation of, say, a competitive bodybuilder, they're not notorious for being known as the greatest of movers. They look good, from a distance. But the reality is, like, if I was concerned about how well I could move, then that would not be the ultimate goal.
Yeah, because from a health perspective, that level of compression is not good for digestion. It's not good for circulation. It's not good yeah. for joint health.
Underappreciated as to the negative secondary consequences.
Because the less space I have in which to move, so all these muscles that need to be very tone, like carry a lot of muscle tone and be contracted mm-hmm. more often than not to right. maintain their size.
Right.
They're squeezing
everything.
The fluid. They're squeezing the fluid out of joints. And a lot of times in one direction more than another, and that creates like a herniation or an impingement.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So you end up with less and less space.
Right.
All right. And again, we don't want relative motion to build massive amounts of muscle. We don't want relative motion to build high levels of force, because that would be in the contrary.
So yeah.
Like, because what relative motion does is actually reduces the force, which is actually a good thing from a health perspective, mm-hmm. from a protective perspective. Right. If we distribute loads through our body, we tend to do very, very well. It's just when we have so much physical structure, and we have trained ourselves to squeeze harder and harder, and we lose that relative motion, now all the joints become compressed.
Yeah.
And then that's where we see, again, a lot of the common wear and tear type of injuries.
And everything starts to move together. People start to move like refrigerators, yeah. waddling. So it's less about, so health would really be like, health is more of the Tai Chi movement ability, where you can stay grounded, you can get up and down with ease, you have no problems like moving up and down mm-hmm. stairs, getting up and down off the ground, like right. all of these things. Yeah. And, but also with the ability, if needed, to go sprint and catch a bus.
Right. It would be a way to look at it would be like relative strength. Like, how strong are you for your structure
yeah.
versus the absolute, which would be, you know, comparing maximals between individuals.
Right. So it's not about like how much you can bench press, but it might be about like, can you get up off the ground from your, if you were laying prone, could you pull yourself up onto a tree branch if you needed to?
Right.
Not like, could I do 50 chin-ups right. or could I do a chin-up with 100 pounds strapped to my waist? Right. Because that there's going to be a cost to trying to get to that level of intensity.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with
those
pursuits.
As long as you appreciate it.
Been there, done that. Paid the price.
And if you're an athlete in one of these sports that requires you to be doing these lifts at a certain high volume, high intensity, then yeah, you're going to have to, there's some trade-offs to make.
Yeah. But understand that. See that, yeah. And that's what we're really talking about. It's like we're not passing judgment on anyone. We're just saying it's like, okay, if you're going to pursue this, these are your potential secondary
right.
consequences.
So the underlying theme of this is balanced training, getting people to understand it's not about balancing, pushing and pulling. Mm-hmm. It has very little to do with that, actually. Mm-hmm. It's more about managing center of gravity, being able to put the force down in the ways that are relevant to the tasks. Mm-hmm. And it's more about like what are managing the secondary consequences of whatever you're doing.
Right.
So do you walk into the gym with the same range of motion and relative motion as you do when you leave the gym?
Right.
And if the answer is no, then eventually you're going to hit a point, unless you're doing recovery, like specifically in between sessions, you're eventually going to hit a point of diminishing returns and potential
right.
well, decrement. Because
part of gym progress, and we'll just use the strength measures as a representation. Part of that progress is again, giving up some physical quality to magnify another.
Right.
So we're always going to have some measure of secondary consequence that's going to be associated with moving in one direction to a great degree.
Sure. Okay. So we talked about the health aspect of it a little bit, and we sort of mentioned like the cost too. From a performance perspective, balanced training is going to be doing what I need to do from a training perspective mm-hmm. to get the output or outcome I'm looking for on the field or in the sport. So am I training in a way to keep my golf drive at a certain distance, my carry distance to be a certain amount,
right.
while also not having to deal with debilitating back pain in between my rounds? So it's like riding that line and that continuum of
right.
can I still perform at a high level, or what sacrifice do I need to make on my carry distance? Like, could I go from like carrying the ball 300 yards, which would be crazy? Would 280 be good while right. also having a back that doesn't hurt?
Right.
Like, that would be the question you would ask from as a training right. perspective.
Right. And that's why we talk about following key performance indicators over time. It's like, you know, I would want my athletes to be able to produce the greatest amount of force that they can without sacrificing the specifics of the sport. So whether we're talking about golf or tennis or yeah. soccer or whatever it might be, it's like, so if I continue on a path you know, to any degree, is like, I have to monitor those things to make sure that I'm not losing like an element of health along the way. And so this could be your hip range of motion. This could be your shoulder range of motion. It could be elbows, could be knees. It doesn't really matter what we're talking about in that respect, but I need to monitor those things over time, because if I can determine, you know, through regular, self-assessment or direct assessment, which would be even better, is like, I can track those things over time. Well, we see this with our professional athletes all the time. It's like, you know, we don't get to work with them in season nearly as much as we would like to. And so then what we see is we get them at the end of the season where they have all of these play related and training related adaptations, and they come in and they feel a certain way. And it's like, then we have to spend, you know, the next few weeks trying to recapture elements of their physical health, because we know they're going to go right back into that. And so if they don't start from a good position, if they don't have sufficient movement capabilities going into these situations, we know they're just going to continue to drift and drift and drift, and then that's where we start to see again more injury.
Right. Okay. So maybe we just finish with maybe talk about some examples of, I guess we could maybe just give a example of like what a balanced training session would even look like. So if we, let's take a traditional bodybuilding, strongman, big lifts perspective, mm-hmm. and say a workout would consist of like a back squat, a bench press, a chest supported row, and then maybe like face pulls. Mm-hmm. Like someone, yeah. And so I'm thinking of like what I, ways I used to train way, way back. So let's say a back squat, bench press, chest supported row, face pull, and then maybe like a tricep push down.
Right. All bilateral symmetrical, all trying to minimize the amount of rotation represented in those activities. Very compressive, lots of internal rotation. And again, high force. It's like, so if that's the foundation of your program, then you have to say, well, number one, what am I willing to give up? Okay, that's fine. But then we have to start to say, okay, I'm giving up my capacity to turn, which allows me to access the external rotation capabilities, which is actually the foundation of your relative motions.
Right.
And so what you would want to do in that circumstance, and there's a couple ways that you could organize this. Number one, I could bookend the program. And I could say, okay, I'm going to do things that help me maintain relative motion. I know I'm going to train in this scenario that's going to be compressive, geared towards hypertrophy, geared towards force production, going to take away all of the stuff that I would use as a representation of health. And then at the end of that program, now I'm going to recapture as much of that as I can, because if I don't do that, then I'm starting the next workout from a position where I would actually have less relative motion. And then the sequence continues until you run out of something that you really, really need. The other alternative would be to sort of alternate activities within the program itself, where I do something that's highly compressive, high force production, and then I alternate that with an activity that actually reduces an element of that, and then I go to the next and to the next and to the next. Now, the problem with that, that type of a structure, I would use that type of a structure for somebody that was a little less enthusiastic about the highest of force production. Where you're alternating, because they're not as concerned about the force production. If I did that with somebody that was like strongman or the extreme, then I'm actually putting them in deficit for the next exercise.
Right. You would be limiting their output.
Right. Because it was like, okay, high force, you know, low force expansion. And then that takes away an element of the force capabilities for the next exercise.
Yeah.
Right. So I would bookend those types of people.
Right. So that's comparing. So going back to what I had said about, if you're talking about the health related, longevity related person, that they need the movement capabilities and to be able to use the ground like someone that does Tai Chi, with also the ability to go like sprint and catch the bus. Right. So that would be what you're talking about, where it's like reclaim relative motion, make sure you have the space in which to move through, but also challenge your output ability.
Right.
So you're never going to hit your one rep max. And if you're training if you're a trainer and you're training somebody to one rep max, it's like, don't do that. But yeah, so it's like the getting them to the point where they can get to 80% of their one rep max. They can get to their they can get close enough to the maximum to be able to keep driving.
Well, it's that satisfactory.
There's an element
of satisfaction associated with lifting heavy things.
Right, and it's the same is true for any type of ultimate or, you know, terminal athletic endeavor. It's like when you train for a marathon, you never run marathons to train for a marathon. Right. When you train for a mile, you not running miles all the time,
right?
At a max speed. You might run like 400s or 800s, right, that are very high intensity.
Sure.
But you're not really like hitting that maximum goal. You're always trying to get close enough. And that number is usually around like 80%, 70 to 80%. And that's enough to keep your maximum or increase your maximum without always getting to it.
Yes.
So I think that's an important way to look at it. And then, so it's like, if that structure doesn't make a lot of sense, if you need to have that more maximum output in what you're doing, then you can take a warm up that starts with relative motion, proceeds into force production, have your training session that's all based on force production, and then have an ending cool down scenario, right, where you get back to relative motions.
Right. And that's the most reasonable way to do that with that type of a goal.
Right. We're going to give some exercise examples of what we're talking about. So so considering a push up as like a symmetrical bilateral movement. So let's talk about like balanced, how you maintain the ability to turn and balance when you're doing something like
that. Yeah. So if anything that's bilateral symmetrical is going to be this emphasis on internal rotation, high compression, right? So if I just do a regular push-up, we're reducing the capacity to turn in that circumstance, right? And so again, highly compressive. If I wanted to maintain some measure of rotation, I can build it into the push-up just by performing the offset version, which would, again, put me in this slightly turned position. So I have this hand elevated and I'm still performing the push-up. There's still going to be an element of compression that's associated with that. But by building in some rotation, I'm actually reducing the amount of force that I can produce.
Right.
And so we're talking about maintenance of a capability to turn. And so just by substituting this in for the bilateral symmetrical version, we can help people to maintain. So this might be one of those supplementary exercises that we're actually going to use. We can build it into the program and say, well, they're still doing, you know, a force producing capability. They're still producing effort. So there's still some satisfaction that's associated with that. But by elevating that, it allows me to maintain the turn. So when I'm in this position here, just by the elevation, I'm moving towards that external rotation, which creates more space and helps maintain volume in the thorax, versus putting both hands down and now I'm going to compress on both sides.
Yeah. So anytime you elevate one of the sides, it shifts the downforce more onto the downside, the one that's not elevated. So it creates the direction of up creates ER space,
1000%.
But also the shift in weight creates more IR on the downside.
Well, take somebody that can't do a push-up on the floor. What is the typical substitution? Oh, we'll just do them on an incline. Well, what are you doing? Well, I'm taking away the internal rotation. I'm taking away the compression. So it's not just the fact that you're reducing you're reducing a load. It's just less. It's literally less compressive, and so they can actually move.
Yeah.
Like people that can't do a push-up on the ground. Not only is it a lack of force, it could be the fact that they're already compressed maximally and therefore they have no more force capability to produce, because they have to be able to squeeze. If I'm already squeezed, it reduces my force capabilities.
Yeah. And you'll see that a lot. Like there's people who can't get off the ground, but then there's people whose like butts will shoot up first.
Yeah.
And then they can actually get off the ground after their butt goes in the air.
Right.
So they're plenty strong to get off the floor. Yeah. It's just that they can't manage the pressure differential that you're talking about, where everything is so compressed up top that the only way they could get any volume there was to actually dump their hips up in the air.
Exactly.
And then create the space. So let's say like an example, we'll just do a lower body example to wrap up, and we'll maybe do like a split. Imagine like you're trying to load up single leg training. I'm making air quotes. Single leg training.
So if you're just listening.
So in that case, if you don't know anything about what you're trying to do, you throw like, okay, well, split squats are good. So I'm gonna throw a barbell on your back and have you do barbell split squats.
Right.
So let's talk about like what that position might do to somebody.
Like with the barbell versus say like an offset load or something.
Yeah.
Like
so
that.
Like let's first talk about the difference between a bilateral squat and a split squat. Like why one would be
Okay, so now we're talking about ERs and IRs again. So so anything that's bilateral symmetrical. So if I put a load on my shoulders and I am symmetrical, I am immediately biasing myself towards a greater amount of internal rotation, which is more of a compressive strategy. So if I squat with a barbell on my back, I am trying to minimize the amount of rotation. So when I put myself in a split position, I'm actually starting from a very broad position of external rotation. So bilateral symmetrical internal rotation, as I split my legs apart, I have an early external rotation representation here, late representation here. Now at the bottom of the split squat, it becomes more internally rotated. If I was to put a barbell on my back, I am actually constraining the axial skeleton in that circumstance, and I'm actually reducing the amount of ER that can be represented in the exercise. So again, I'm reducing the turn, right? So again, you have to play with loads here. So this might be why you would use like an offset load, where so I'm starting in an element of ER, I'm adding IR here. If I move the load to the outside, I'll turn it this way so you can see it. If I move the load to the outside, I'm actually expressing more of the external rotation again. So again, just by the position of load, I can help control and influence the element of the ERs and IRs.
Right.
But again, the bigger, more symmetrical load that requires me to resist the rotation immediately moves me towards more IR.
Yeah. So the load placement will dictate what the axial skeleton behavior is.
Yes.
Loading it on the back, loading both hands is going to squeeze more equally front to back.
Correct.
Offsetting will allow for a shift, just like putting your hand on a box or putting your foot on a box mm-hmm. would offer a shift in the center of gravity. So
we can build some of these rotations into higher force representation, like a suitcase carry kind of falls into that same category as the offset load on the split squat. So if I did a suitcase carry, I have a stronger expression of external rotation on the side of the load. I have a stronger expression of internal rotation on the opposite side of the load in that circumstance. But if I make it a symmetrical load, now I have reduced the external rotation on both sides. And so again, if I have somebody that is trying to maintain a larger measure of health, then these offset or asymmetrical loads become more useful. They're still loaded activities. They're still satisfying as far as training is concerned in level of difficulty. But the ability to maintain measures of health that are associated with relative motion are much easier to do with the asymmetrical loads.
Yeah. And it's always a question of how much is enough for the given person.
Correct.
And I believe the answer for that question is often much less than you would think. Especially when it comes to like aesthetic goals. I think a lot of people are convinced that you have to train super hard in the gym at all times to be able to look a certain way, when in reality, it's probably 98% diet.
Yeah. Yes, very much so.
But that's not fun.
Like exactly. Yeah. So you maintain the muscle mass that you start with, but you get leaner, you always look more muscular.
You look great. Yeah.
You always look more muscular.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you train like a madman, you're in pain all the time, and then you're eating more because you think you've somehow earned it. Those are the people that are always like, I can't get rid of this last little bit of this.
Yeah.
The question we're going to talk about is what was your weirdest like food combination as a kid? Like what would like people think is kind of gross, but they're trying to think of one.
I got one that just popped into my head. Wonder Bread.
Yeah.
Butter.
Mm-hmm.
And then the clear Karo syrup sandwich.
I mean, that's not too bad. I'm kind of thinking
that's,
like,
that's pretty weird.
Yeah, like gross stuff. Okay. My mom used to do this thing that I don't do anymore, but it used to be sandwich with like white bread, mayonnaise, lettuce, and then peanut butter.
Oh.
So it's like replacing the meat, like turkey, ham, whatever, right, with peanut butter. Oh, it actually works. As long as it's not really sweet, if it's just like normal peanut butter that doesn't have extra sugar in it, the peanut butter just is like the meat in the sandwich.
I don't know, the mayonnaise combo with
it's
that
better,
is killing me.
It's better than you would think. I haven't had that in forever, though. But yeah, leave in the comments like your weird food combinations from a kid, being a kid, or even now if you want.
There you go.